So I'm thankful again to have this opportunity to be in front of you again after a long time of not being up here. This first part is going to be basically me reading something because I want to get this straight. I want to get it right and correct something that someone pointed out to me that you may hear this again because I don't know who all was here. I gave a lesson. Let me just start off. Anyone who knows me knows that I encourage everyone to look things up for themselves in our classes and any class that I teach. I say, don't trust me. Go back to the Bible. Look it up. This was drilled into me from the time I was a kid. I've always been in church. I've always gone to church. I was very, very fortunate with the parents that I had, the grandparents, the great-grandparents that I had, and I'm thankful for that. And it was drilled into me to look things up. Another piece of advice I got while I was in the military was trust but verify. And a lot of you have heard that as well, right? Trust people, but go back and look at the source document that they're talking about, whether it's a regulation, an instruction, whatever. Go back and look at the source. For us, it's the Bible. This is all we have to go by. It's all we should go by. We shouldn't come up with anything else. I remember sitting in my grandmother's class in preschool, or preschool class on Sunday at church. This is how important your job is as teachers. You have, any of the teachers here, have an extremely important job. And I give you all the praise for what you do and thank you for what you do for teaching the classes. She would tell us a Bible story, much like what you do with the little kids. She would drill it into us that we should always be specific on what the Bible says. This was my lesson from, it was over a year ago that I gave this lesson. And it was on being specific. It was on going back to the Bible and always looking things up. This was something she drilled into us every Sunday. It was something my mom, my dad, my grandfather, my grandparents, great-grandparents, they drilled into me, my sisters, our cousins, that always go back and don't go off, don't say something off the off your cuff, go back. And when you're studying with somebody, have the Bible open so they can see. So it's not something you're making up, so they'll see it. I kind of feel like Timothy sometimes. My mother, my grandmother, my grandfather, my dad. So I'm thankful for that. And again, that's something that if we sit out in the classes that we teach on Sunday morning, we're always going back and saying, look it up for yourself. Let's go, let's turn, let's not take my opinion or your opinion. Let's see it word for word. So I gave that lesson a little bit over a year ago and used three examples that a lot of people, unfortunately, in the world get wrong in the Bible. Now, these may not be major things, and you'll see that what Adam and Eve ate in the garden, that has no bearing on your salvation whatsoever. However, if you go out and you tell that as fact, you're adding to the Bible. You're adding to something that God didn't want you to add. If he wanted us to know what fruit it was, someone said it was a pear, and I had always heard that it was a passion fruit, making the joke. But we don't know what the fruit is. That was my example. And apparently, I might have said that it was an apple. Now, I'm sure anyone who's spoken in front of a crowd knows how nervous you can get up here. And you might say something you may not mean. Kind of a Freudian slip. You're focused on, do not say that, do not say that, and then you say it. That could have been what happened. Now, this other story I've told up here before, maybe somebody sitting in the audience dozing off, and they hear a little bit of what's going on. My uncle, Uncle Herman, he was my grandfather's brother, loved him. He was the funniest man I ever met, but he was dozing off in class one Sunday morning, and they were talking about Zacchaeus. And the teacher said, now, who was that man that was up in the tree? Uncle Herman dozing off, not really paying a lot of attention. All he heard was, who was the man up in the tree? And he woke up and yelled out, Tarzan. And for him, he could have just been doing it for a laugh, but with him, it could have gone either way. Whatever the reason, I want you all to know, we do not know what fruit was in the Garden of Eden, what fruit that Eve gave Adam. But let's go back and look at that. Turn back to Genesis. It's in Genesis 3, 1 through 6. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, 'You shall not eat of every tree in the garden?'" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the tree. We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, 'You shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Now, not a single reference to any particular fruit was made there. But in the world, you ask anybody, and they'll say, 99 times out of 100, they'll say it was an apple. Go back to the text. No matter what the subject is, whether it's about this or whether it's about baptism, whether it's about what must I do to be saved, which is the most important question anyone can ask. The other example I gave was the wise men. Every Christmas, when we just finished Christmas, got through the holidays, and the story of the wise men. There were wise men. You go to any, again, those 99 people that think it's an apple think there were three wise men. We don't know how many wise men there were. So if we turn over to Matthew 2, 1 through 12. And I'll say this, you talk to people, some denominations, I know some friends that we have, family members go to a denomination, they have a pageant. Some have a pageant each year, and they have a play, and they have the three wise men. They even have names for the wise men. So they've gone, not only they're narrowing it down to three men, they have their names. Now, you give that much detail on a story, people will take that as fact. I don't want to be in their shoes. Even though, again, this isn't something that is going to do anything to your salvation, if there were three or 100 wise men, or only two, it's not going to make a difference. But when you start adding to the Bible, that's where it makes a difference. Because if you'll add to that, more than likely, you'll add to something else. Or if you just believe what somebody says without looking it up, you'll go through life believing whatever is said without checking it out for yourself. So, again, that's the point of this. So Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, again, no mention of how many, determined from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the young child, and when you have found him, bring back word to me that I may come and worship him." When they had heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when he had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Then, being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way. Not one time did they mention how many there were. They mentioned three gifts, But there could have been six wise men, and each of them brought a different gift. But all those gifts, we know for a fact, was gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We don't know how many people there were. Again, not a big deal. We don't care how many people, how many wise men there were. It is a big deal when people add to what's in the Bible. That is a big, big deal. The third example I gave was the root of all evil. Now, this one, I've been corrected twice on this sermon, so I'm refining it as we go along. But this one, I know that I said, and I had a good friend at Green Valley, John Loffrey, came up to me afterwards, and he corrected me, and we'll get to that in a minute. But what is the root of all evil? What does the world say? If you say the root of all evil, they'll say money. It's not money. It's the love of money. Now, here's where the verse is, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. That was what John corrected me on. He said it's the root of all kinds of evil. So let's turn over there and let's take a look at that. And that one is in 1 Timothy 6:10. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Now think about it. Money is a good thing. Money, you need money to live, to pay your bills and everything. But the world, whether it was, who knows why it came, well, I know why it came down to people saying money is the root of all evil. They don't go back and read for themselves. Had they gone back and read for themselves, they would have seen money is the root of all kinds of evil. I think the King James, though, says, and I think that's what I was using, the King James, original King James, says that the love of money is the root of all evil. But, again, go back and look at this. That was my lesson from over a year ago, and I would ask this morning. It's a great example, perfect timing. Glad you did this on purpose to help me out today, Bruce, by giving that verse and then correcting it immediately. If I say anything, if anybody up here says anything that's wrong, go to them immediately after services. Right now, I don't know who was here that night that I gave that lesson. I want to go to every single person and say, if I said that, I was wrong, and I want you to know that I was wrong. Give me that opportunity, or whoever's up here, give us that opportunity to go back to that person and correct it. That's just what you need to do. So that's the first half of my lesson. This is going a lot quicker than what I expected, and it's not because of any game, because I really don't care about the Super Bowl. And I'm glad to see you all here tonight, by the way. I'm very thankful to see all of you. So, summarize. Go back to the Bible. Have it open. Study with people. Read it with them. Not to them. Read it with them. Have them look at it together. You can't go wrong with that. Second half is going to be totally different than the first half of this lesson. We've started a class on Sunday mornings. It started because, we had wanted to do one after we had done the lessons up here on the different parts of worship, why we do the things that we do. And it's kind of morphed into a question and answer type class, so an open forum class. And we've sort of started with the basics of the Bible. Letta's in there, and she's really a brand new Christian. She was of a denomination before, and she's only been baptized, I think, 3 years maybe? And so she's learning. There's a lot of people that are learning. So I'll put a plug in for the class on Sunday mornings too. If you are interested in that, we're looking at why is the Bible, how can we rely on the Bible? How do we know that the Bible is true? And a lot of people don't have an answer to that. They just say, well, I just have faith. I just believe that it's true. But one of the segments that we talked about was scientific facts. And I think this is interesting, and I know that we're going to have, we're talking about, the men had talked about having, he's an archaeologist. He's a member of the church and teaches at, I can't remember what college, one of the Christian colleges. I just can't, I don't know. Anyway, He teaches at one of the colleges. He's going to come here, so he'll go probably, oh, I know, more in depth and give you even more stuff. But these are good things to have. Just to open a conversation with somebody. I work with some people who are dead set atheist. One fella, I know I've talked about him before, he was a lieutenant that worked in my squadron. His dad is on CNN all the time. He's the lead atheist for, I don't even pay attention to him, but whatever atheist organization that is. And he's always on there, and he's always causing trouble for the Air Force. The Air Force has had to take down the Ten Commandments out of the Air Force Academy, this cross they had up, they had to take it down or modify things because of this guy's dad. I would hate to be this guy's dad in the end and have to answer for all the things that he's had to do. But we can go back and look at the Bible, and there are scientific facts in the Bible that are, some of them that I'm going to mention, were just confirmed 1977. So, well, let's just get into it. So, there are a lot of facts in the Bible. How did we get the Bible, and why are they? How do we know that they're correct? And how did the Bible get them correct? Well, for one, we know the writers were inspired, right? So we have to accept that. That's part of the faith that we have, is accepting that the Bible was inspired. The men that wrote the Bible were inspired by God to write the Bible. These stories were also, especially in the early Jewish families, these were handed down from generation to generation, father to son to grandson to, you know, just through the generations, they were handed down. There was an importance on the Bible that we need to have. So I want to give you some examples, and again, these could be something you could use to start a discussion with a friend or someone who doesn't believe in the Bible or in God. They prove the Bible has never changed. The Bible will not change. It hasn't changed, won't change in the future. It's the same right now. Let's go back to the beginning of the universe, or what the majority of the people in the world think, how the universe was created. So what is that? The Big Bang Theory, right? Not the TV show, but the Big Bang Theory is what a lot of people believe started the universe. Totally separate subject, but another lesson would be some in the church will try and twist that to make it tie into the Bible, but that's a totally separate lesson. I'll probably put something together on that, but Big Bang. The Big Bang Theory, and then I'm going to talk about the face on Mars. So the universe, according to man, was created by a bunch of cosmic dust that just happened to appear. They have faith in that. That dust has always been there. It's always been there. And then something happened. There was a spark. Now, what caused that spark? We know now that there has to be, you know, combustible items, oxygen, and all this. But something caused that spark. But that spark was caused, and all this mass of stuff, this cosmic dust, exploded and created exactly what we have here. Put the Earth just at the right point away from the sun that could sustain life. It put a moon around our Earth that will control the tides, control the water. It will... Pluto was a planet. Now it's not a planet, but we'll get into that in a minute. So they believe this. They'll believe that that dust has been there forever. And in college, my professor, that when we went through this, he could never answer the question, well, where did the dust come from? What caused that spark? Well, it just occurred. They'll believe that, but they won't believe that there's been a God that's been around from the beginning of time. There is no time with him. He's just always been. He has always been around. So they don't believe that. No, there will not be a God, but there was dust. It just spontaneously happened. It was an accident. How lucky are we? Look at where we came. Look at where we are now. So the second thing is the face on Mars. We sent I don't know if it was Voyager, but we sent a probe up to Mars. As it's circling around, they see this mountain. And this mountain it looked like a face. And you can look this up. Just look up face on Mars on the internet, Google it, and you'll see this face. And it looks like a face. No kidding. It looks like they built a face on the surface of Mars. When scientists saw this, they were jumping up and down, or the people that believe the Big Bang and that there are life, there's life on other planets, they were jumping up and down. See, we told you, there's life on other planets. How else could that face have been formed? Couldn't have been done by accident. No, no, no. We have confirmed that there's life on Mars. Look at that face. Well, over the years, that's 1976. Over the years, up through 2001, we've gotten better and better in pictures. And basically what you have is the same thing as if you went into Arizona or New Mexico and looked down at a butte or a mesa, and that's what you saw. And that eye and that mouth and that nose were shadows. We see that now because we have great pictures of it now, more refined pictures, high definition. You can look at it and you can see it. It was no face. But those same people that believed in the Big Bang, who believed that everything could have been done by accident, were able to believe, couldn't believe that that was done by accident. That had to be formed by somebody else. So these are the scientists that we follow, right? So whatever they say, they're scientists. They've studied this. They've confirmed this, although it's still a theory. One more example like that, the Brontosaurus. Now, I know the Brontosaurus, outside the Flintstones, it was discovered in 1877. This fellow discovered this, the most intact dinosaur skeleton ever found. They painstakingly dug it up. They took it to the English Museum of Natural History, I believe, and put it back together. It said, behold, the Brontosaurus. So that was 1874, sorry. In 1903, it was discovered that this Brontosaurus was actually the skeleton of two separate dinosaurs, the front half of one, the back half of the other, and the head of something else. So the scientists did it. They discovered it. We taught it in school. But in 1903, it was discovered, no, that's not true. However, the U.S. government in 1989 issued four stamps, four dinosaur stamps. Guess what one of those stamps was? The Brontosaurus. 1989, look it up, the Brontosaurus stamp. Yeah. And it was taught in school. And again, these are the things, these are the scientists that we trust because they discovered these. They're scientists. They can't do anything wrong. Come on. So this next one is neat, and this is where we're going to get in the Bible. So grab your Bible, open up to Job 38. Now, Job was no scientist, or whoever the writer was, Moses, or whoever the writer of Job was no scientist. So Job 38, verse 16. Have you entered the springs of the sea, or have you walked in search of the depths? Springs of the sea. What in the world is he talking about? Well, we discovered that. We discovered springs in the sea. What's a spring? Spring is water coming up out of the earth, right? Well, and this was in 1977, the Galapagos Islands. Now, that is an awesome place to find this, I think, and we'll get into that in a second. Galapagos deep sea hot springs were discovered by three geologists. They went into a submersible, went down 2.5 kilometers, a mile and a half, and found these springs that were coming up. The water was superheated by the magma in the core of the earth to over 600 degrees. The first thermometer they took down, it melted because it was so high. And anyway, they brought up life forms they had never seen. But it confirmed what the Bible had talked about. I don't know what Job thought when he wrote this, the springs of the sea. I don't know what God put in his mind. He might have given him that revelation, hey, I have springs down here below the sea that you don't see. And he helped him understand that, I guess. But our scientists didn't figure that out. We didn't discover that until 1977. Now, the reason I think Galapagos Island is a wonderful place for those to be discovered is what else is known for, what is Galapagos Island also known for? Well, it's where Darwin spent most of his time trying to, or coming up with the theory of evolution. Again, theory of evolution. Darwin, of all people, on this island, when a biblical fact is at his feet, under the sea, I think it's a great place for something like that to be discovered. Another thing I want to talk about, just move down a few verses, is verse 24. And this is New King James. It says, by what way is light diffused? Diffused. What's he mean? Well, what's diffusing something? It's separating it, right? Well, light is, it's white, right? That's what the scientists said up until the 16th or 17th century, around 1650. Isaac Newton discovered that, yeah, you can diffuse light. You can run it through this prism, and you see the rainbow. And then you can run it through another prism, and it combines them all into white light again. He proved what the scientists had been saying all along, that white light is a single color of light instead of the total of all the colors of the spectrum. But hold it. Job talked about this. By what way is light diffused? I wonder if Noah ever thought about that. You know, when he saw the rainbow, God already diffused the light. We saw Roy G. Biv, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. So we can see that. We can see that every time it rains. And how's that happening? The water is getting diffused through the water in the air, in the sky. Or the light is getting diffused. There you go, that Freudian slip there. The water is, the light is being diffused through the water, and we see the rainbow. But Job talked about it, and we didn't discover it until 1650. But that's another thing. If you talk to people, just interesting things that maybe you can pique their interest. Oh, well, if that's true, well, that's kind of interesting. Now let's turn back two chapters to Job 36:27. For he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunder from his canopy? So he draws up water, verse 27. He draws up water, or draws up drops of water, which distills as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Now turn over to Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 7. It says, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. Well, what's that talking about? That's talking about the water cycle. The water evaporates, creates the clouds. The clouds are moving across the sky. They get up against the mountain. The mountain acts as a squeegee, and just the water falls, or the water gets too dense in those clouds, too heavy, and the rain falls. We didn't discover this until the 1500s. Bernard Palissy is credited with this scientific discovery in the 1500s. But Solomon, or the writer of Ecclesiastes, talked about it. Job, the writer of Job, talked about it. These facts were already in the Bible however many years ago, thousands of years ago, 5,000 years ago, or whenever the Bible was written. And then what would be something today that we use, especially now with down in Africa with Ebola, quarantining. So turn back to Leviticus 13. And that's the law, the heading in here. Of course, we know the headings are just added, but the laws concerning leprosy. Leprosy, what's God tell them to do? Let's see. Verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, then he shall be brought to Aaron, the priest, or to one of his sons, the priests. The priest shall examine the sore on the skin of the body, and if the hair on the sore has turned white, and the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it is a leprous sore. Then the priest shall examine him and pronounce him unclean. But if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body and does not appear to be deeper than the skin and its hair has not turned white, then the priest shall isolate the one who has the sore 7 days. He's quarantining him for 7 days. And the priest shall examine him on the 7th day. And indeed, if the sore appears to be as it was and the sore is not spread on the skin, then the priest shall isolate him another 7 days. Then the priest shall examine him on the 7th day. And if indeed the sore has faded and the sore has not spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It is only a scab, and he shall wash his clothes and be clean. He quarantined him. God taught us that back in Leviticus. He taught the Jews as they were learning directly from God, this is something you need to do to stop the spread of this disease. This could be used on any disease. Now we have the measles outbreak. Well, if people were to separate their children and keep them away, they wouldn't. We could knock this out. What's the first thing the CDC does when we have something like this? Let's separate these people. Quarantine them, and that way, you know, only they're infected, and hopefully we can cut it down. We see this. But the 14th century, what happened then? We had the bubonic plague, the Black Death, went through England, or went through Europe anyway, and it killed 75 to 200 million people. Had they done what God had told them to do, they could have cut down quite a bit on what. But the scientists weren't that, weren't pushing that. But again, go back, the Bible, it talks about it. It's another thing that I think you can use to prove that, yeah, we have a reason to have a faith in the Bible. We have our faith isn't based on nothing. So, unfortunately, a lot of people will only rely on what scientists see, what scientists can prove. Even more unfortunate is that scientists aren't always correct. Again, I've given you some examples of the things that they weren't correct in. The earth is flat. You're going to fall off the edge if you go too far out. We've obviously proven that wrong as well. But, you know, it's unfortunate that they can't, they're not always correct, but people will put their faith in what they can apparently see, right? I can see now, I see that if you put light through a prism that there's a rainbow, it's different colors, you've proven your point, I believe that now, I see that. Well, for us, let's turn over to 2 Corinthians 5. Second Corinthians 5, verse 7. So what's that say? It says, for we walk by faith, not by sight. And then Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So faith, we have this hope. We have this hope that at the end of our life, we're going to stand before God, and he's going to say, come in, my well and faithful servant, and that what we've done during our life has been right. That's our faith. We have that faith. We haven't seen God. We haven't seen Jesus. But we have this faith. The faith is built on what we read in the Bible. And this Bible is the only thing that we have or should have. and the only thing that we should base our faith on. So as you go around, you talk to your friends, or people in the store, whoever. These are just, like I said, just some examples that maybe help build your faith in what you're reading. Yeah, this is really true. But we also have that faith that that these words were inspired by God. So, again, this hasn't been anything on salvation or how to become a Christian. But I believe everybody here is a Christian that I know of. You need to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized and live your life the way God would want you to. And you have that opportunity to do that. You also have that opportunity if there's been something that you've done publicly that would warrant coming forward or just wanting the prayers of the church, to come forward and ask for the prayers and ask God for that forgiveness. And I'd ask you to do that as together we stand and sing.